Good evening, guests, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this ordinary general meeting of the Institute of Actuaries. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on the 22nd of March have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? All of those of you who read it. Thank you. We have some distinguished guests tonight, and I'd particularly like to welcome Sir Richard Dole, Emeritus Professor of Medicine, Clinical Trial Service Unit and Epidemiological Studies Unit at University of Oxford, Nuffield Department of Clinical Medicine. Professor Diana Koo, Senior Research Scientist, Medical Research Council, and Professor of Life Course Epidemiology, Royal Free and University College Medical School. Professor David Coleman. Is David here?
He's in the middle there.
There he is. What are you doing back there? Professor David Coleman, Department of Social Policy and Social Work, University of Oxford. Tom Bolt, I didn't see before. Tom, welcome. Tom Bolt, Managing Director, European Division, Berkshire Hathaway Insurance Group, Berkshire Hathaway International Insurance Limited, and Marlborough Underwriting Agency and Tenancom Limited. And Dr. Ian Curry, Department of Actuarial Science at Heriot-Watt University, and personal guests of members. I've now remembered my mobile's on. I shall now turn it off, if you'd like to do the same. I shall now read some proposals which have been recommended by Council that Jukka Rantala, Sir John Bannum, Professor Leslie Mayhew, and Derek Wanless be elected as honorary fellows. The proposals will be posted on the Institute notice board until the AGM on the 5th of July, when a ballot will be held in accordance with Bylaw 55. Jukka Rantala is Managing Director of the Finnish Centre for Pensions, Chairman of the IAA Insurance Regulation Committee, and of the Actuarial Society of Finland from 2000 to 2004. A council member of the IAA from 2000 to 2004. A member of the Finnish Solvency Working Party, which cooperated with the Institute's General Insurance Study Group Working Party on Solvency in the 1980s. Co-author of an important study on solvency and equalisation reserves published in 1982. And did a PhD on an application of stochastic control theory to insurance business. I hope when it comes to the vote, you will support Jukka. Sir John Bannum was chairman of the Professions Inquiry into the Provision of Financial Information and Advice and gave a keynote lecture based on the findings of that inquiry. Has actively promoted the provision of affordable financial advice and the importance of a savings culture. Has continued his association with the profession by chairing several meetings at Staple Inn to advance the dissemination of financial education. Past Director General of the CBI, past Chairman of the Government's Retail and Consumer Affairs Foresight Panel, Chairman of Whitbread, Geest and ECI Ventures Group, and author of lots of reports. Leslie Mayhew, Professor of Statistics at Cass Business School, formerly Director in the Office for National Statistics, formerly Director of Operational Research in the DSS and responsible for administrative finance and planning for the whole DSS group. Expertise in modelling health and social security systems, including related policy and service delivery aspects. Recipient of two grants from the Institute of Actuaries covering the field of long-term care, and published a paper for the Staple Inn Actuarial Society on disability, you got that wrong, it's on the brain at the moment, global trends and international perspectives. And also Derek Wanless of Northern Rock PLC, Director of Business in the Community, Commissioner at the Statistics Commission, member of Sir John Bannum's panel on financial information and advice, produced a report in April 2002, Securing Our Future Health, Taking a Long-Term View, for the Chancellor of the Exchequer, advisor to the Welsh Assembly in its review of health and social care, and a keynote speaker at the Professions Health and Care Conference. So as I say, when it comes to the AGM, I trust you'll all be here and vote, or vote for them by the postal ballot before. The next piece of pleasant duty is to welcome Angus MacDonald, Richard Willetts, Adrian Gallup, Tony Leandro, Rajiv Shah, and Ian Curry. Now, you'll notice there is some commonality with the authors of the paper tonight, but the reason that we're welcoming them is to award a prize. Council decided that their paper, Mortality Improvements and the Cohort Effect, presented to the Life Convention in Birmingham and the Stapling Actuarial Society, was worthy of a prize for the best institute paper written in the 2002-2003 session. It was of immediate practical use and would have enduring relevance. Sponsors of the paper commented, "It's a milestone paper in reserving for annuitant longevity improvement. The paper was seen as one which could influence thought in this particular area, was readable, which is good for an actuarial paper, and applicable in a wider audience." So I'd now like, if I could ask you to come up in order so we can take your photo. Angus, Richard, Adrian, Tony, Rajiv and Ian, and I'll present them with their certificates.
And each of the check for £16.66.
Now to the two papers. I'm delighted to introduce two papers, one, Longevity in the 21st Century, by Richard Willetts, Adrian Gallup, Tony Leandro, Joseph Liu, Angus MacDonald, Keith Miller, Stephen Richards, Neil Robjohns, John Ryan and Howard Waters, and also an additional paper, The Cohort Effect, Insights and Explanation, by Richard Willetts. And I'd ask Gary Crofts to open the discussion. I beg your pardon? No, I read the wrong line there. I now ask Richard Willetts and Neil Robjohns to introduce the paper. There you go.
There you go. I thought I got away with having to do an introduction there for a second, but unfortunately no. The two papers being presented today have much in common. Obviously, they are both concerned with trends in mortality. However, they also share a common desire to tap into the wealth of relevant medical and demographic research that is now available. In recent years, there's been an explosion in the volume of such research that is readily available. The growth of the internet in particular has made projects of this kind immeasurably easier, and it is now possible to refer to vast numbers of medical papers and seemingly endless data sets of health and mortality statistics. This has changed the way in which we can approach the task of projecting future rates of mortality. Statistical models applied to raw mortality data are still needed, but more and more they need to be shaped by an understanding of the fundamental forces driving mortality change. The Working Party paper will be introduced shortly by Neil Robjohns. However, I would like to make some additional comments about the other paper, The Cohort Effect, Insights and Explanations. The main Working Party paper discusses many aspects of a vast topic. The Cohort paper looks at one particular aspect in much finer detail. The existence of the so-called UK cohort effect, the upward step change in life expectancy experienced by the generation born 1925 to 1945, has been much discussed in recent years. Notably, the Continuous Mortality Investigation Bureau published a working paper, now a prize-winning working paper, in 2002, which described the existence of the feature in assured life and pensioner experience. The paper contained interim projections of future mortality rates which allowed for this trend. The release of the CMIB working paper had a profound impact on the life assurance sector in particular, and a number of companies strengthened annuity reserves as a result. In 2003, a CMIB working party on mortality projections began research on the construction of a new projection basis to be published with a new set of standard tables based on experience from 1999 to 2002. And it was during this research project that the work on the cohort paper before you first began in earnest. As an aside, the CMIB Working Party has now published a discussion paper on methodologies that could be used to project future rates of mortality. This discussion paper is now available for download from the profession's website, and the CMIB is actively seeking feedback. It's also worth noting that a date of 4th of June has been set for a seminar to discuss the contents of the CMIB paper. One question the CMIB Projections Working Party was looking to address was whether projections should be done primarily on a cohort or a period basis. After compiling some initial research into the potential causes of the cohort effect, it quickly became apparent that this one topic could take on a life of its own. I'm therefore grateful to Angus MacDonald in particular for encouraging me to pursue this avenue of research. In many respects, the cohort paper provides more questions than it answers. It looks at possible causes of the UK cohort effect and examines research in related disciplines. To me, the work in related disciplines was the most interesting aspect of the work. Sometimes when you do research, you come across a piece of work that radically shifts your perceptions as to what is possible. In 1998, I felt this when I discovered a paper by the demographers Tolger, Perker and Bowe, which had been produced as part of a Society of Actuaries project into mortality improvement. The paper was called Mortality Forecasting: How Much and How Little Do We Know? And it certainly made me realise just how little I knew. I would still recommend the paper to anyone wanting to be impressed by the sheer scope of the subject. More recently, I felt the same thing when I discovered the work of epidemiologists such as Diana Koo. Professor Koo was kind enough to send me a paper she had written, which, amongst other things, explored actuarial research at the beginning of the 20th century. It quickly became apparent that whilst epidemiologists were delving into actuarial history for insights, actuaries have much to learn from present-day epidemiological research. In particular, there are striking parallels between the life course approach in epidemiology and what actuaries could and should be trying to achieve in the field of mortality projection. I was particularly taken by a quotation from Professor Michael Wadsworth, who is one of the leading figures in a group of epidemiologists who have sought to understand the impact of early life experience on health and mortality in later life. Professor Wadsworth claims that a degree of anticipation is possible within lifetimes through those things which make an imprint on life at one point and which are carried forward on into later life. I think a common misconception about mortality improvement is that future rates of improvement are largely dependent on the occurrence of future events. I believe that a significant element of future improvement can be anticipated given what has happened in the past. I believe the paper demonstrates this most clearly in its analysis of lung cancer mortality and historic patterns of smoking. In a recent article in the Actuary magazine, the chairman of the profession's Media and External Relations Committee bemoaned the fact that people who compile longevity statistics are seen as, to use a technical term, geeky. He went on to claim that actuaries would look a lot more rounded and a lot less technical if we weren't so closely associated with mortality statistics. As you might be able to guess, I don't entirely agree with this point of view. I probably should defer to others the question of whether I or my co-authors specifically merits the allegation of geekiness. However, I do believe there is nothing geeky about the subject of mortality. Mortality statistics are not mere abstract numbers. Each one in the exposed to risk and each one of the deaths is a human life or a human life ended. Mortality statistics are therefore profoundly significant numbers in a way that stock market values or interest rates can never be. The struggle against mortality is one of the overriding preoccupations of human society. Furthermore, trends in longevity could have huge social and economic consequences. Mortality has played a key part in the history of the actuarial profession, and I certainly believe it should play a major part in its future. Okay, on that note, I'll hand over to Neil Robjohns.
Thank you, Richard. The initiative for our paper, Longevity in the 21st Century, emerged from a meeting in January 2003, chaired by Brian Ridsdale. He had been asked by FAMC to lead a task force to answer one specific question: how could actuaries learn from medical advances and knowledge about the causes of early death to better predict mortality? A number of initiatives flowed from that meeting or were tied together by it. This paper, which started from an update and an extension of Richard Willett's 1999 SCIAS paper, Mortality in the Next Millennium, is but one of those initiatives. So to give the paper its proper context as part of an overall strategy to tackle that question, I should like to start by outlining some of the other current work in progress. The CMI has greatly increased the pace of its activity over recent years, evidenced not just by its reports, but also by the growth in the number and size of its active working parties. The CMI's initiative of working papers has begun to engage the wider profession much more in its deliberations. Two of those papers have already been mentioned this evening. The first provided a highly colourful and I think very convincing illustration of the cohort effect exhibited in insured lives data and centred on the year of birth 1926. Paper 3, issued in March this year, is the one that summarises or discusses projection methodologies. The CMI and GAD jointly sponsored a seminar in Edinburgh last year to discuss mortality projection methodologies and also brought in speakers from outside of the profession to give us an insight into recent and potential medical advances, particularly at the current frontiers of life expectancy. The Actuaries Panel on Medical Advances is now swinging into gear, and funding has been secured for a 3-year research project at Heriot Watt University looking into coronary heart disease and stroke mortality. This will study the known risk factors and the potential impact of medical advances on them, and will, we hope, give us some insight into possible trends in mortality from heart attacks and from strokes. The executive panel of APMR is also considering whether similar investigations might be possible in other aspects such as cancer. And finally, whilst not part of the profession's initiatives, the GAD recently generated much interest and debate following its publication of revised mortality projections for the population as a whole. Turning to the paper itself, the authors firmly believe that future projections must be grounded on as good an understanding as possible of the past. Accordingly, much of the paper focuses very heavily on England and Wales population mortality over the whole of the 20th century, and I should like to begin by drawing out 3 particular aspects of this. First, thinking of the entire 100-year time span, let's just note the sheer scale of the changes in mortality rates, in life expectancy, and of the relative importance of different causes of death. and note in particular a number of examples where that degree of change has simply been beyond the common imagination of preceding generations. Narrowing that timescale down, we focus in the paper particularly on the last four decades and draw out five major factors which have shaped recent mortality changes. Key, of course, is the cohort effect, which for the population as a whole peaks for the group of lives born in 1931. And we also give evidence in the paper that the effect is still strengthening as those lives now progress through their 60s and into their 70s. And finally, focus down onto just the last decade and take a detailed look at the relative causes of mortality and how they vary by age and sex, and also at the trends within each of those causes. We see this section of the paper as the vital platform on which to build any understanding of how medical advances may affect future patterns of mortality. The paper then moves through some international comparisons. Here I think it helps us just to consider the degree of variation between different populations and therefore potentially the scope for future changes. We go on in section four to consider medical advances. Now this is such a huge field that we could only in the paper give a little bit of flavour, and we picked on just two particular aspects. Whilst those topics I think are fascinating in themselves, I would urge you just to stand back from the detail and simply contemplate just the enormous pace of change and the scale of potential medical advances. In similar vein, the paper also looks at some of the challenges that may affect the scope of future mortality improvements, and we considered infectious diseases. But again, perhaps we could have considered a number of other areas. The focus then narrows to the mortality of older lives and increasing life expectancy in retirement. We briefly discussed the issues around mortality, around projection methodologies, although the much more substantial work on this is the recent CMI working paper. A key point to note is the great uncertainty around mortality projection and the need to consider a reasonable range of projections. We then illustrate the potential implications if the cohort effect were to continue as the lives at its core progress through their 70s, maybe into their 80s, and possibly into their 90s. And evidence of a cohort effect in Japanese mortality data shows that it is indeed possible for such effects to persist quite strongly, even at very advanced ages. We focused on this particular example because it has such significant current implications. However, we've also tried to outline some of the other implications across the much broader spectrum of actuarial work and social policy. In conclusion, we certainly hope that the paper will serve as valuable CPD material and as a useful reference source. We also hope the paper, along with so much other current work, will help to inform the profession's advice, both collectively and through individual members, on future mortality of pensioners and annuitants. But I should just like to go back to that broader strategy. Here our hope is that the paper will also serve to engender debate on what more the profession should be doing in this complex field of mortality. And to kick off that debate, I briefly offer two personal thoughts, maybe a little provocatively. First, I recently received a brochure for the 2004 Pensions Convention. Now, this isn't my field, so I apologise if I'm a little ill-informed. But what struck me from the brochure was how little reference there was to mortality in there. Mortality was headlined in just one workshop, that's one-hour session, in direct competition with five other workshops, and that's the only mention of mortality in a whole two-day conference on pensions. I just wonder whether this really is a fair reflection of the importance of the topic. Second, while we can now readily demonstrate our work in respect of this cohort effect exhibited by lives born between 1925 and 1945, we do stand accused of picking up the issue rather late. My question to you is, are we yet doing enough to get on top of any new issues, the emerging obesity epidemic, for example, and how these might affect future mortality? Thank you.
I shall now ask Gary Croft to open the discussion.
Thank you. One industry expert has estimated that there is about £1 trillion of pre-retirement pension liabilities in UK occupational pension schemes and in insurance company pension funds. The GAD have estimated that the unfunded public sector pension liabilities are about £370 billion. And liabilities for annuities in payments of UK insurers are close to £130 billion. Now, by my reckoning, that means we've got total pension liabilities in the UK of around £1.5 trillion. Correcting a 1% understatement of these liabilities will cost employers, insurers, policyholders and taxpayers about £15 billion, which averages out to around £250 per head of population. And we're not talking about potential 1% misestimate, but estimates of maybe 10% are not implausible. And this has led to an investment bank, one investment bank analyst report recently commenting on these papers that longevity is now the second greatest, if not the greatest, risk for UK insurers. And actually, I think the potential cost of unrecognised improvements in life expectancy is possibly the greatest or one of the greatest financial risks facing UK insurers, employers and taxpayers. It's a great surprise, therefore, that until recently there have been very few papers devoted to the topic of mortality improvements and their financial impact. And also I would support what Neil has just said in that this whole topic of mortality has not been at the forefront of this profession, which is quite surprising. And you can see that as well in the back offices of life companies and reinsurers. The relatively low prestige which is given to the study of mortality. However, I think that is changing. These two papers, Longevity in the 21st Century and the Cohort Effect, represent significant contribution to our understanding of the causes of improvements in mortality, and the authors are to be congratulated. I agree very strongly with the authors when they state that future projections should be grounded in as good an understanding of the past as possible, and the bulk of both papers is devoted to improving our knowledge about the past. However, in order to be of use to actuaries and economists, we need to use this knowledge of the past and combine it with what we can reasonably discern about the immediate future and project out quite a large number of what-if type scenarios in order to build up a plausible range of future estimates of life expectancy. We need to understand the width of the funnel of doubt. Looking back, it's very startling to remind ourselves just how much life expectancy has increased during the 20th century. Life expectancy at birth for males has increased by 27.4 years to 80.6 years, largely due to improvements in infant mortality and the near eradication of deaths from infectious diseases. In percentage terms, the gain in life expectancy at 65 for males has been nearly as great, and this now stands at 84.1 years, with most of the latter improvement being achieved post-World War II through reductions in mortality from circulatory diseases and cancers. It's beyond my imagination to think that similar gains in life expectancy from birth could be achieved in the 21st century, as infant mortality is now so low. But could we see similar gains or even greater in old age life expectancy? This would imply a male life expectancy at 65 for close to 92 years, or 27 years from age 65. And what does this mean for average year-on-year mortality improvements during the 21st century? Whilst alluding to some of the medical advances that might be required to sustain the 20th century pace of mortality improvements, the authors have probably quite rightly steered away from trying to guess long-term improvements in life expectancy, and have focused on mortality improvements for those in retirement or close to retirement age today. Clearly, the authors believe very strongly there's enough momentum in recent mortality improvements to sustain very high levels of improvement for the foreseeable future, and they identified five key forces driving change at the beginning of the 21st century: the cohort effect, the ageing of mortality improvements, the increased uncertainty at younger ages, changes in the prevalence of smoking and widening social class differentials. The so-called cohort effect has been an issue for debate in this profession for a few years now, certainly since 2002, when the CMI Working Party brought it right to the forefront of our attention. However, the CMI report didn't attempt to answer the questions such as what has caused the cohort effect and is it likely to continue? And this left many actuaries feeling that they had no choice but to adopt the cohort projections in setting their reserving bases, which cost most insurers between 2% and 4% of reserves, but with no opportunity for having an objective discussion about the appropriateness of this basis. And these papers do an excellent job in filling in those gaps. The patterns of mortality improvement supporting the cohort theory are set out once again, but we now also get a detailed explanation of some of the causes of the effect. Improvements in diet, the introduction of the welfare state, the health benefits that is provided for the general population, and changes in the prevalence of smoking. Richard uses insights from epidemiology, social science, and demography to demonstrate that year of birth influences in mortality are not an unusual effect, and then goes on to use evidence from the mortality experience of Japanese women to show that cohorts do exist in other populations and their effect can be long-lasting. I think some demographers would still say that there is no scientific proof of the cohort effect. But at the end of this, what I'd call a one-sided analysis, I find that I am convinced that there has been an observable cohort effect in the 20th century, that it is likely to continue through the early part of the 21st century, and that there's no law in nature to suggest it should not. One of the main factors driving the cohort effect has been changes in the prevalence of smoking. Smoking prevalence has now been reasonably stable, though, for the last 10 years for men. But we did observe large reductions in smoking prevalence in the 10 years prior to that. And Richard puts forward evidence to suggest that the beneficial effect of giving up smoking on heart disease mortality is negligible 10 years after cessation of smoking, but the impact lasts for much longer for lung cancer. However, as circulatory diseases kill four times as many men over aged 50 as lung cancer, it is a much more important influence on old age mortality. For men in their 50s and 60s, the reduction in mortality from heart disease has accounted for 1.8% per annum of improvements in the 1989 to 2001 period, or about 60% of total improvements for this age group. For men in their 50s, approximately 45% of this total came from changes in smoking prevalence. With stability in smoking prevalence rates, the heart disease-related future mortality gain from cessation of smoking needs to be extracted from the cohort effect. And even though there is a much longer half-life for smoking-related lung cancer deaths, there will also be reducing mortality gain from this cause as well. The authors, and I don't want to sound critical, but partly that's why I'm here, the authors do not want to seem to recognise this when they put forward the basis for projecting future mortality improvements, and they in fact ignore one of their own observations in constructing the basis A and B projections in section 6. Earlier, the working party showed that the cohort effect for the general population was centred on 1931 year of birth, but it was centred on the 1926 year of birth for the insured population. The difference between these two is thought to arise from the earlier adoption of a healthier lifestyle, particularly in giving up smoking, by the higher socioeconomic groups represented in the insured population. However, bases A and B both assume that recent population mortality improvements will continue in the insured population, even though that population is 5 years ahead in terms of lifestyle improvements. I do not say that basis A and B projections are implausible, but I do ask, where in the range of possible scenarios do they fit? Projecting future life expectancy is clearly a very difficult task. As well as all the underlying medical factors that can influence life expectancy over time, one has to also consider very carefully the characteristics of the group being modelled, the time period over which you're projecting, and the range of ages you were trying to cover. The funnel of doubt obviously increases with time, as there is more scope for the benefits of medical research to have a significant impact. But the years of life saved by current medical research for those already in retirement cannot be so great. The section on projecting the future seems to appeal to the evidence of the recent past high improvements in mortality, together with factors such as the government health targets and medical advances, to suggest that we should expect at least the same for the immediate future. Well, maybe, but maybe not. Once again, where in the range do these scenarios fit? I think it's always going to be difficult to cover understanding the past and projecting the future in one document. And for me, this is where the Working Party paper does leave room for further research. And in part, that's probably being covered by the CMI paper. They have identified a number of methods for projecting future mortality, but they do settle, in their paper, on a purely extrapolative approach for building the projections in the report. This leaves me asking, what would cause mortality to change at such a rate, and how likely is this to happen? How credible are these forecasts? I feel that we do need to look at different approaches to forecast in order to get a better understanding of the range, and process-based methods would help us to do what-if type projections based on pipeline medical developments, e.g. what if there is a mass screening program for one of the major cancers together with a 99% effective treatment regime. Even though I'm in favour of process-based projections, I still think that extrapolation methods have a big role to play. There's always going to be a large element of long-term mortality development that will be due to factors that we can't possibly foresee today, and these factors could work in both directions. I think that's the important thing, that over the long term, things can work in both directions. Standing at the start of the 20th century, though, would anybody have clocked close to predicting life expectancy at the end of the 20th century, and will we fare any better today? As a speaker at this institute, Jim Open, showed in his paper on the gold standard, there has been an uncannily persistent growth in life expectancy of 3 months per annum for the last 160 years in the highest level of life expectancy throughout the world. Simple relationships like this may continue in the future for reasons that we don't know or understand. However, with the UK somewhat short of this gold standard at the moment and the current emphasis on improving the health service, it will be no surprise if population mortality does continue to improve at rates higher than the rates for other advanced economies. And with that, I'll end my commentary.
The discussion is now open to the floor, so that we can do our little calculation as to how long each of you get who want to speak. Could I please have a show of hands of those who'd like to contribute?
Cool.
Everybody.
Good.
Excellent. Right.
Three, I think.
Right. I have a list of 11 who've given me their name. So what I'm going to do, and also to incentivise people to do the same in the future, is to give those 4 minutes. And those of you who are not on my list who speak afterwards, I should give 3 minutes. And my timekeeper, Samantha, will make sure that she does it properly. but I will start with Ian Curry, because Ian wants to do a PowerPoint presentation, and then we can lose the screen. Okay.
First, I'd like to congratulate the authors on their paper. Papers, wide-ranging, scholarly, and stylishly presented. The papers are not in any way scaremongering, but nevertheless, they make scary reading for the profession. Section 6 in the paper on longevity discusses the projection of future mortality rates. We learn that future mortality improvements depend on a frightening list of unknown factors. What will be the impact of medical advances on cancer rates and heart diseases? Will we see the ending of senescence within the lifetime of people in this room? In the opposite direction, will there be a reduction in the life expectancy of the young of today because of damaging lifestyle choices? How should we take these unknown effects into account? This seems a hugely difficult question. My own approach is rather different. I simply look at the pattern in mortality in the past and try to project this pattern into the future. So if I could have the first slide, please, Chris. This slide shows log mortality rates from a set of assured lives for the period from 1947 to 1975. Can we predict the course of mortality over the next 25 years? The next slide shows an estimate of the underlying mortality, which I've assumed to be smooth. And the next slide shows a projection of these smoothed rates. And the next slide shows how this fared against how the mortality actually unfolded over the last 25 years. Not too bad, but we didn't get it right in the 1990s. More seriously, we got it wrong in the wrong direction. Given the essentially crystal ball nature of the task, perhaps we shouldn't be at all surprised at this. However, these projections are done using a statistical model for the number of deaths, so we can calculate confidence intervals for the projection. And the next slide shows that the actual observed future mortality rates lie comfortably within the funnel of doubt. Notice too, as has been remarked by the previous two speakers, that the further we project into the future, the more uncertain we become. And this is, of course, surely common sense. Now let's next slide, please. Now let us come forward to the present day. Here is the whole of the last data set. And here is the smooth on the next slide. And here is a projection to 2050. So we can see that my reading of the past is that we're going to experience very large improvements in mortality over the next 50 years. And the next slide shows the confidence intervals. No data yet, so I'm quite safe in making these predictions. Good methods of projection are essential, but we must not make the mistake of thinking that even the best of methods will get it right. Projecting future mortality comes with a risk. The confidence interval is simply one measure of this risk. This risk must be priced. Over to you.
Can we lose the... Thanks very much.
As Jeremy said, my name's David Brand, and I'd like to concentrate on, I think it was section 7 in the main working party paper, on the implications for life assurers, and also in particular make some comments on my own area of experience in life reassurance. And the authors quite correctly draw out the experience that reinsurers have had of monitoring the improving mortality and protection business, and hence their perhaps early perception of improvements in mortality in annuity business. This is indeed true, but there has been a major difference historically between protection and annuity business. Our methods of selection for protection business and annuity business over the years have been totally different. For protection business, we've become very efficient in linking the selection of the risk to the risk factors and the pricing. Although we haven't gone as far as the USA have in the range of factors used, we still employ age, sex, smoking status, and we combine these with a range of medical and lifestyle selection tools, ranging from a simple proposal form through doctor's reports, medical exams, blood tests, and the like. Although the introduction of genetic testing is bringing its own issues, we do feel we can obtain a very good idea of the risk we are accepting. Contrast this with the historic annuity market, where age and sex have been our only selection factors, and for protected rights business, we can't even use sex. Our annuitant pool is made up of an extremely wide range of lives with totally differing mortality experiences. Our pricing has been by no means as sophisticated as for protection business, and nor have been our mortality investigations. A simple example of this point is very correctly made in the paper, that the proposed increase in the commutation limit to, I think it's 15,000 rather than the 14,000 said in the paper, under the new legislation, could remove from our annuitant pool many of the lives with a worse than average mortality experience, which naturally makes the mortality experience of those remaining even lighter. It is perhaps this logic that has led to the development of the impaired and enhanced annuity products described in the paper, as insurers and reinsurers have tried to analyse the risks they're running and aim to link their pricing and selection to gain a better understanding of these risks. To draw the link between the protection and annuitant business again, it's apparent that, on the face of it, for protection business, healthy lives are perhaps more acceptable for insurers than unhealthy lives. But insurers and reinsurers have over the years become very comfortable in accepting the vast majority of unhealthy lives at increased rates. As the annuity market moves to include more impaired and enhanced products, it's clear that at the moment these lives are more attractive to insurers and reinsurers. They have been selected out of the main pool and have a shorter life expectancy. For these lives, there will be less time for mortality improvements than the general population will experience to take effect. But in the same way that we've become comfortable with unhealthy lives for protection business, as long as they're selected properly, I would say that in future we may also become more comfortable with the healthy lives for annuitant business. I would add one perhaps major caveat, that we must understand the projected improvements in mortality a whole lot better. This is all fine in theory, but I foresee a major problem that we'll have to overcome in practice. As selection grows, the effect of what we might call the standard market becomes inevitable. This will mean that the wealthy and healthy lives with larger pension funds, dare I suggest including some of the people in this room this evening, will receive the lowest annuity rates. Many of these lives, and not necessarily the ones in the room, will become unsatisfied with the situation, and this will compound the current position where our clients already feel that annuities provide poor value, despite the fact that we in the industry are worried about profitability. We as an industry may improve profitability by improving our risk selection, but we'll have a major challenge in explaining this to our clients and the public and the media as a whole at a time when the perceived pension problem is receiving more publicity than ever before. I would like to thank the authors for the work that's gone into the paper, and to close by picking up the point in section 713, the implications for the profession. Mortality may not be one of the most glamorous topics, but I agree with the openers that it remains one of the core areas of actuarial expertise, and I certainly agree that we must continue this research in the future.
David Gulland and then Eugene Hertzman.
Thank you. I thank the authors for what I found to be one of the most inherently interesting and fundamentally important papers for a long time. Affecting as it does our work in numerous fields. In fact, just today I was working with James Randley Foundation on long-term care, and again, they were looking forward for the implications for their projections of long-term care costs. I'd like to add a couple of points supporting the author's comments on mortality variations by socioeconomic class and the relevance of international comparisons. In section 6.5, the authors describe the uncertainty over whether the current widening of mortality experience will continue or not. One potential driver for continued and possibly widening differentials is the importance of childhood diet. The impact of diet is touched on by the authors in paragraph 4.10.1 in relation to laboratory work on rodents, but is somewhat dismissed. However, the study by in Frankel et al. In the BMJ of 14 February 1998 showed how excessive calorie intake in childhood is linked to additional mortality from cancer at adult ages. I think this is one example that Richard Willis mentioned in his remarks about how early age effects impact later on. Unfortunately, the UK is starting to see increased obesity in children, as indeed Neil Robson mentioned, and although I have not checked the figures, this is likely to be more of a problem for poorer families. Perhaps we need models that project not only aggregate population or insured life mortality, but that models that are built up using projections for different socioeconomic groups. And I recognise that's even more complexity to what we're currently doing, but I think it's needed. The international comparisons set out in section 3 are fascinating and driven by numerous factors. It is a pity that the authors could not explore this in their paper, but two factors are likely to be comparative health expenditure as a percentage of GDP and diet, once again. As we know, the UK's current health expenditure as a percentage of GDP is well below the EU average. But the current government is committed to increasing expenditure substantially over the next 5 years to move above the average. Such expenditure may reduce the deficit in heart disease and cancer mortality rates shown in figure 3.4 and table 3.5. and makes the sixth bullet point on page 73 of great relevance and importance in considering whether the UK can achieve international rates of mortality. Just touching on diet again, for example, in 1998, the UK consumption of butter was only one half of that of 1984. So things do change and they feed into mortality figures. For insurance companies, the increased variation in mortality across groups of individuals and the uncertainty over future improvements will mean that not only will insurers need to have a good understanding of their own portfolio in both protection and pre-funded long-term care insurance business as well as annuities, but also the need for scale will become ever more important, both to reduce the likelihood of unexpected excess exposure to any particular consumer group or socioeconomic group, but to also lessen the impact of normal mortality variations. Finally, thank you again to the authors for such a good and comprehensive paper. Thank you.
Is Eugene Hertzman here? Yes, here he is. And then Richard Humble.
Good evening. The understanding of the impact of likely future medical developments are, I believe, important issues that require consideration by the CMI Mortality Subcommittee when choosing a model to project future mortality rates. A simple example of this is a point illustrated by Formulae 10 and 11 of the Working Paper 3, which shows that the average rate of mortality improvement will decrease if medical advances are concentrated on a particular major cause of death, with much less improvement achieved on other causes. With hindsight, it can be seen that the method used in CMIR 17 to project future mortality improvement rates imposed what appears to be an inappropriate assumption concerning the runoff of mortality improvement rates at advanced ages, which are of major importance for annuities. I believe the material presented in these papers demonstrates that this rapid runoff pattern is unlikely to occur, but there is still, I believe, considerable uncertainty concerning what constitutes a plausible model of long-term future mortality improvement rates at advanced ages. An important issue to understand is the past and likely future impact of smoking, and this subject is covered both in the longevity and cohort papers. Table 219C of the longevity paper indicates that, at least for the ages shown, changes in the prevalence of smoking seem to have accounted for about 1 to 1.5% per annum of the observed annual improvement rate in the 1980s and 1990s. Many actuaries believe that this implies that as the effect of changes in smoking prevalence leveled off during the 1990s, future mortality improvement rates compared to historic levels would reduce accordingly. The more detailed study of lung cancer mortality improvement rates in the longevity paper and the section on smoking in the cohort paper paint a slightly different picture of changes in smoking prevalence having a long-tailed impact on lung cancer mortality rates and a relatively short-tailed impact on heart disease mortality rates. This implies that changes in smoking prevalence before about 1990 will continue to have an impact on lung cancer mortality rates, but little impact on heart disease mortality rates in the late 1990s or in future periods. I found it difficult to reconcile figures in Table 219C of the longevity paper with those in Table 5 and paragraph 7.35 of the cohort paper, probably due to the different periods, age ranges, and base mortality rate against which improvements were measured. I believe this is an area that needs to be explored further to demonstrate that trends due to changes in smoking-related behaviour are being adequately reflected in any projection of future mortality improvement rates. One particular area I found of interest was Table 27B, which indicated a large change in mortality improvement rates at ages over 70 in 1998 to 2002. Unfortunately, information on the breakdown by cause, such as that in Table 28A or 216A, was not provided to help explain possible causes of this feature. I think it is important to try and understand fully the drivers of this important change. Moving on to issues of presentation, I have some comments that arise from Table 611A and 611B of the longevity paper, which illustrates ratios of annuity values on various different bases. I think I'll submit these detailed comments on the numbers as a written contribution, as I think I'll probably run out of time if I do otherwise. But one point I'd like to come back to on that table is there was an example of a serious misinterpretation in a paper by an equity analyst stating that the CMIB is likely to recommend a move to at least the GAD 2000 basis immediately, with a move to benchmark B likely in the long term. As far as I can see from Working Paper 3, this is an unwarranted conclusion, as the Working Paper seems to indicate that no recommended change to the cohort projections, other than their use with the new 1999 to 2002 tables, is likely this year. Now, I should add that it's entirely appropriate for the subcommittee not to be pressured into making a recommendation till they have adequately researched the alternatives. In reading the section in the longevity paper on AIDS, I'm reminded of the projections on AIDS made by the Institute AIDS Working Party in the late 1980s and early 1990s. I don't want to dwell too much on the history of what happened at the time, but in summary, AIDS Bulletin 1 issued in September 1987 projected an upper and lower range of between 80,000 and 310,000 deaths by AIDS by 2002. AIDS Bulletin 5, issued in March 1991, reduced this range to between 17,000 and 38,000, and this compares with a table in the appendix of the longevity paper of around 15,000. It's probably coincidental that the numbers are quite close. I remember the debate in this chamber at the time when a commonly held view was that the AIDS Bulletin 1 lower basis was implausibly low and officers should reserve and presumably price on a basis equivalent to a level of about 200,000 AIDS deaths by 2002. If this view had prevailed, it would have had serious implications for parts of the industry. In conclusion, I believe it is an understanding of likely future medical developments and the ages that are targeted on that is important, rather than proving the existence of a cohort effect or whether it can apply to advanced ages. As the cohort paper concludes, it provides more questions than answers, and I believe it is important to try and answer some of these questions before recommending a basis that may prove to be inappropriate with possible adverse implications on the industry. We need to ensure that initial views do not become entrenched before they are shown to be plausible and consistent with known facts, and avoid what very nearly happened at the time of the AIDS scare. Thank you.
Richard Hummel and then Gavin Jones.
My name is Richard Hummel. I'd like to begin by congratulating the authors on these two excellent and excellent papers, which have clearly required a great deal of work. I wish to confine my remarks to the paper Longevity in the 21st Century and to concentrate on two areas which seem to me to have particular relevance to the CMI projections. Firstly, the cohort effect, and secondly, the assumptions relating to mortality improvements after the cohort effect runs off. Taking the first, there's been an obvious discussion about the importance of changes in smoking prevalence to the cohort effect. Colleagues and I have constructed a model of the impact of changes in smoking prevalence on mortality and concluded that a large part, but not all, of the past observed cohort effect is attributable to it. We have further explicitly projected forward the contribution expected in future from the improvements in changes in smoking prevalence, and use this in order to adjust the projections carried out by the CMI, i.e. we stripped out of the base historic cohort effect the contribution of attributable to smoking, projected the remainder forward using the CMI's same basis and methodology, and explicitly added back the effect of smoking projected by our model. This resulted in annuity values several percentage less than those obtained by the CMI medium cohort. I conclude that smoking, as others have observed, has largely run its course as a major driver of future mortality improvements, and that the CMI medium cohort overstates its future impact. Turning now to the life after cohort, if I can so term it, Longer-term mortality improvements are discussed in Section 4 of the paper, in particular ageing and the implications for notions of an ultimate limit to life expectancy. The CMI assumes, after the cohorts run off, that improvements trend over the very long term to zero, i.e. a fixed mortality table at every age. This is a very important assumption, which requires much more discussion and justification than it has received, which is a discussion having tended to concentrate on the cohort effect. The authors, in section 2.18.10, suggest that the improvements in elderly longevity in recent decades undermine theories of a maximum lifespan. I don't personally think that this is, in fact, a logical implication. In principle, one could conceive of a situation in which there were some maximum limit to life expectancy. I'm not saying that there is or isn't, but one could conceive of that, coupled with regular and substantial decreases in mortality in ages up to that ultimate limit. What I do think the improvements of recent years seriously call into question is the CMI's assumption of trending to a fixed mortality table with fixed rates at all ages. I would like to conclude by once again thanking the authors for these excellent papers. Thank you.
Gavin Jones, and then Philip Olivier.
The research in the papers presented today shows how in developed economies, particularly since the Second World War, important causes of mortality as older ages, from cardiovascular disease and cancer, have moved away from terminal acute events to much better diagnosed chronic conditions. So we should expect a reduction in mortality, though maybe not in healthcare costs. By contrast, infectious diseases continue to adapt. For example, influenza immunisation programmes depend on the prevalence of a dominant strain and therefore implicitly continued non-trivial mortality levels. With that reduction in mortality, the financial consequences of variation at longer duration are more significant. As the CMI acknowledge in their interim working party 3, standalone tables are limited in their ability to account for that variation. So the assessment of the stochastic impact of mortality should clearly be a key part of the process setting capital requirements for business subject to longevity risk. With that understanding, it may be possible for us to price non-diversifiable longevity risk more reasonable than previous generations. Focusing on future improvements should also orient us away from graduating to notional limiting mortality rates, exactly the same point as Richard. This is surely a hostage to fortune for deferred annuities and ongoing defined benefit schemes, which have longevity exposure uncomfortably in excess of 50 years. These risks magnified in a low interest rate or even deflationary environment. Further analysis of the financial impact of longevity variability and improvement is an important step if we are to support newer products such as equity release or long-term care, as well as demonstrate our ability to manage our ongoing annuity portfolios. That will be the subject of a SIAS paper this autumn. With that rapidly changing structure of mortality, of course, the market has also changed with the development, for example, of impaired annuities. It is likely that as much of the risk to our longevity portfolios resides in the exposure to greater selection and business mix effects, as from those unforeseen changes to mortality improvements documented so interestingly in the papers presented today.
Philip Olivier and then Brian Ridsdale.
Hi there, the name is Philip Oliver. The papers presented here today make a significant contribution towards our understanding of mortality, and I would like to thank the authors for the valuable contribution. The authors mention in Longevity in the 21st Century that the profession has recently been criticised for not keeping up with the likely changes in life expectancy. In my view, these papers go a long way towards restoring our reputation in this area. My comments will focus on projecting the future, and all my references are to longevity in the 21st century. In paragraph 6.6.3, the authors state that all projection models include a significant element of subjective judgment. Paragraph 6.10.3, which discusses the CMI's recent paper on mortality projection, again refers to the uncertainty in fitting a statistical model to past data and also to in the choice of the most appropriate projection model. Insurance firms are currently busy with the implementation of the individual capital adequacy models, and for many of them, the mortality risk present in the annuity portfolios has been identified as a key risk to identify and understand. The important risk is not binomial variation, but rather variation in future mortality trends. The regulator has expressed a preference for a stochastic approach in the quantification of the risks that companies face, and in my view, this approach should not be followed only for the assessment of market risk, but also insurance risk. Capital requirements are the topic of paragraph 7.5, but I would have preferred the paper were more explicit regarding the potential usefulness of a stochastic approach. The practical challenges of calibrating a stochastic approach should not be underestimated, in particular if you require a 1 in 200 ruin probability over 1 year. This will require a model of the reserving basis at the end of year one. Unfortunately, a large history of projected mortality tables is not available, and it is therefore difficult to determine the behaviour of reserving bases over time. It is clear that model and parameter uncertainty is likely to remain a challenge in the years to come, both indeterministic and stochastic models of mortality. In paragraph 6.12.6, the authors state that large changes in mortality can occur over relatively short periods of time, and that users of actuarial advice should be aware of the possibility that substantial changes in mortality could occur in future. Again, my view is that this risk is best communicated by considering stochastic scenarios of future mortality trends. I agree with the authors that models should be grounded in as good an understanding of the past as possible. To me, the key next steps to use are much improved understanding of the past, provided by the papers presented here today, to improve our stochastic models of the future. This will significantly improve our understanding of the financial risks taken by the insurance industry and the capital requirements that arise due to these risks, even if significant model uncertainty remains. Thank you.
Brian Ridgedale, then Andrew Smith.
May I add my congratulations to the team for the excellent work in bringing this paper before us, and to Richard Willits on his paper on the cohort effect. Given that the research project was first mooted in February 2003, it's particularly impressive that the team has managed to prepare this wide-ranging report, not only on longevity, but also on implications in such a short time. Drawing as it does on the experience of the CMI, GAD, from life companies, medical research and academia, and completed by a team of volunteers in their own and their employers' time, it speaks well for the commitment of actuaries to the development of the profession and the public interest. The past few years have seen the actuarial profession's social policy agenda widened with a number of initiatives, many of which were referred to, particularly the ones starting from February last year by Neil Robjohns earlier. I would add, too, the ageing population group and the ongoing relationship with the International Longevity Centre, where we've seen a number of interesting angles on or theories on the development of longevity, some quite challenging or extreme, which provide a good backdrop to thinking on longevity. I commend the authors of the paper on their willingness to focus our minds on the future, and in particular on, firstly, the proposal to introduce to the exam syllabus a requirement to understand some of the basic ideas of demography, health, medicine, epidemiology and gerontology. This would certainly help our new generation of students to better appreciate potential changes in mortality and morbidity, and it would hopefully equip them better to participate in the wider fields, particularly those involved in social policy. And secondly, the proposal to require the trustees of final salary pension schemes to disclose the mortality assumptions used in some form, for example, by illustrating sample life expectancy values now and at future dates based on the choice of mortality basis. Of course, the appropriate basis may vary from scheme to scheme, and it would fall to the actuary to explain why. Finally, it's clear to me that making financial sense of the future doesn't mean predicting the future, still less foretelling the future. It means designing products and structures that adapt to future change and are therefore, as far as possible, future-proof. I note that both the GAD and the CMI have done their best to communicate that uncertainty, the funnel of doubt in future projections. And it's important that we too, as a profession, are able to communicate that issue clearly, or else we risk again being accused of underestimating or overestimating improvements to longevity.
Andrew Smith and then Mike Wadsworth.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'd like to add to previous speakers in thanking the authors for the work that's gone into these important papers. I'll pick up the theme of stochastic mortality projections, which is raised in 6.6.3 of the longevity paper, and in particular the impact on the values of options and guarantees. For example, a guaranteed annuity option is a put option on mortality expectations. It protects the option bearer against a fall in mortality expectations, or equivalently, against rising market annuity prices. A guaranteed renewal option for term assurance is a call option on mortality expectations. It protects a policyholder against a rise in their own expected mortality relative to the population as a whole. The option to lapse a regular premium term assurance policy is a put option on mortality for similar reasons. Even today, it's unusual to see explicit provision in financial statements for these mortality options. To analyse mortality options, we need a stochastic mortality model. Section 683 quotes the Lee Carter model, and David Wilkie's influence in this area can be seen in models described by Patrick Lee in 2000 and by John Hibbert in 2003. These models all generate log normal decrement rates. I'm going to outline four issues to look out for in choosing a model. Firstly, calibrating mean mortality. Secondly, simulating future mortality tables. Thirdly, calibrating volatility. And fourthly, population heterogeneity. Let me discuss mean mortality first. All the models that I mentioned so far allow the simulation of stochastic cash flows, for example, from an annuity portfolio. They're easy to calibrate so that, on average, future mortality rates are consistent with an initially specified table. Unfortunately, thanks to correlation effects, calibrating mean rates is not the same as calibrating the mean number of lives as future dates. This discrepancy gives rise to a bias where, under typical parameters, mean annuity cash flows are overstated by up to 10%. It's a challenge to eliminate this bias. Secondly, consider future mortality tables. A GAO becomes valuable if the guaranteed annuity price is cheaper than the market alternative. So you need a model of the market alternative to price GAOs. Immediate annuity prices are not based on perfect foresight of numbers of deaths, but rather on mortality tables in force on the date of retirement. To price a GAO, therefore, you need not only to project actual mortality flows, but also changes in future mortality tables. Given a stochastic mortality model, we can model future mortality tables as conditional expectations of a future number of lives. Conditional expectations are famously difficult to calculate in a Monte Carlo environment, but thankfully there are some analytical tools available for this. I'll skip now to my... I'll submit in writing the third point on calibrating volatility, but I would like to comment on a point that David Brand made on changing segmentation in mortality options. Taking section 796 to its logical conclusion and assuming a continued insurance exemption from anti-discrimination laws, We can imagine a future where immediate annuity rates depend not only on age and sex, but on occupation, weight, blood pressure, geographic location and other indicators, just as is the case for motor and household insurance. Such segmentation could further increase GAO costs, because the healthiest pensioners are most likely to benefit from the GAO. Conversely, an imposition of unisex annuity rates could reduce GAO costs. I've enjoyed reading today's papers, and I thank the authors for their hard work. There's much more to be done to describe not only mean mortality, but also the likelihood of different future outcomes. Mike Wadsworth.
Thank you. I would also like to applaud Richard and his colleagues for the outstanding papers and for bringing together such a wealth of research. The question is, what do we do now? We could envisage a world in which the Transport Ministry insisted that whenever we start a journey where we hadn't travelled before, we firstly would have to drive in reverse and look out of the back window as we travel, and secondly, that having started on our journey, we were not allowed to change direction at any stage. Longevity in the 21st century emphasises how fast our understanding of the patterns of longevity is changing relative to the periods over which pensions or annuity promises are made. It's interesting, looking at the references in the report, only about 5% of the references listed at the end of the paper are more than 10 years old, and some 60% are dated 2000 or later. There appears to be an expanding gap between the periods over which pension schemes and insurance companies are continuing to provide longevity promises and the periods over which reliable predictions of longevity can reasonably be made. The information and analysis given in the paper can help us to develop useful scenarios as to how future patterns of longevity may emerge. However, the range and diversity of possible patterns also appears to suggest that long-term longevity forecasts could be subject to a wider range of plausible outcomes than we had previously expected. Of course, it can be appropriate for businesses, be they employers or insurance companies, to make commercial judgments about taking on risks that can, by their very nature, only be assessed imperfectly. However, if these judgments are made in the absence of proper information or understanding, and the consequences are undeliverable guarantees or broken promises, or indeed promises that can only be met by imposing on third parties, confidence in pensions will not be helped. Reflecting in particular on section 7.13 of the paper, the implications for the actuarial profession, I hope that actuaries will initiate and promote more informed debate on the risks, costs, and sustainability of longevity guarantees. A consequence of such debate may be that lifetime guarantees of a scale and duration currently offered become less readily available, or at least much more expensive, and form a smaller part of retirement income, with various combinations of shorter-term guarantees and self-insurance of longevity becoming more important. It is possible for annuitants, especially at older ages, to derive substantial benefits from pooling longevity risk that reflects actual experience rates over limited periods, and to separate such pooling from writing guarantees as to the long-term trends in these rates. Models such as that referred to in 7.9.2 allow this separation of the components of longevity risk to take place. To use an analogy, changes in technology would make writing long-term guarantees of motor or household insurance rather dangerous. Consumers self-insure the long-term trends, but still derive benefit from pooling risk period by period. reviewability of rates is becoming commonplace for protection products, a similar outcome for longevity insurance seems inevitable. However, there is then much useful research to be done in establishing a more limited forward market in longevity over various durations. In summary, longevity in the 21st century should encourage us to be more accepting of uncertainty and consequently more concerned with adaptability and risk sharing than with long-term prediction. Finally, I hope that sequels to this excellent paper will be produced at regular intervals, given the potential for rapid change in longevity implied by it.
I'll ask the Honorary Secretary to read a written contribution from Peter Akers.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I wish to congratulate the authors on producing a most comprehensive and readable paper, which not only summarizes the current position, but also objectively describes the potential outlook for the future. It occurs to me that there are some risks that cannot be fully managed by private capital alone. Examples include extremely rare events with huge possible impact and risks that are potentially open-ended. Longevity is one such risk, which also has the characteristic that the degree to which it can be diversified is limited, since if it happens, it will affect many, if not all, segments of a portfolio of business. The almost complete absence of reinsurance capacity to protect against longevity risks at any price indicates to me that I'm not alone in reaching this conclusion. Nevertheless, the availability of insurance products that protect individuals from the adverse consequences of unexpected longevity is a socially desirable thing, and so we should strive to find a mechanism to enable insurers to write such business within prudent standards of financial management. In these circumstances, I suggest that there is a need for some form of state-sponsored longevity reinsurance. Without such a reinsurer of the last resort, life insurers may be forced to design products that pass high levels of risk back to the policyholder, which would be not only defeating the basic objective, but also raising the prospect of yet more mis-selling complaints when the product design and its constrained benefits eventually become apparent to consumers. In labelling the concept state-sponsored longevity reinsurance, I do not mean to imply that the vehicle should necessarily be state-owned. A structure that could work well in practice would consist of a pool owned by participating insurers, which provides initial layers of longevity reinsurance capacity, with a government guarantee of further capacity becoming available if, for example, mortality rates for the general population improve on average for ages over 65 at a rate greater than X percent per annum over a five-year period. A mechanism such as this would do more than provide insurers with a means of satisfying the demand for longevity protection products. It would also put the final cost of improved longevity back with government, and through government to taxpayers. This feedback loop is missing from the current system, which is perhaps one of the reasons why successive governments have failed to address the real consequences of mortality improvements. Government does not feel the pain, which is therefore absorbed by the elderly. Finally, if we can see that the rise of longevity is a multinational event, then perhaps the solution should also be constructed as multi-state sponsored longevity reinsurance. Possibly that implies a greater degree of international cooperation than we can reasonably expect. Not my words. At least in our lifetime, whatever that may turn out to be. I thank the authors for a timely and stimulating paper.
Pete Akers writes, of course, from India.
Mr. President, I should like to present some unpublished data. We've had the opportunity of following a cohort of British doctors for 50 years with known smoking habits at the beginning and known changes in those habits over the period of the 50 years. The cohort initially included all ages from 21 to 99. The youngest members of the cohort in the 1990s are now over 70. We can therefore compare properly the mortality rate in the 70 to 90 year olds in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s in a homogeneous, relatively homogeneous social class with knowledge of their smoking habits. I don't want to say much about the trend in mortality in the smokers. In fact, it hardly changed at all. 1% of them survived to 90 at the beginning and 1% of them survived to 90 at the end. The benefits of medical treatment being counteracted over that period by what I call the maturing of the smoking epidemic as gradually older and older people came to have smoked since adolescence. What I think is interesting, Mr. President, is what's happened to the lifelong non-smokers. The lifelong non-smokers' mortality over those 50 years has halved. 3% of them survived to the age of 90 in the 1950s. 33% of them survived to the age of 90 in the 1990s. Thank you, sir.
I was given the name of Professor J. Olshansky. Is he here?
Yes.
Can I suggest that after him you might like to call David Coleman? Both of them contribute to the International Longevity Group.
Well, it's a fortuitous set of circumstances that actually brings me here today, and I'm absolutely delighted to have just a couple of minutes to comment. And of course, I really didn't have a chance to read this from beginning to end, but I realized just how difficult it is to produce a manuscript of this sort, and my congratulations to the authors. Just a couple of comments, actually just three. The first has to do with this notion of a biological limit to life, which is attributed in the manuscript to myself and Leonard Hayflick. And what I will tell you is that there is no credible biogerontologist today who argues for the existence of a biological limit to life. Certainly not myself, certainly not Leonard Hayflick. We have never made that argument, and we will never make that argument in the future. What we do argue for, and this is important to recognize, is the existence of genetically fixed programs for growth, development, and reproduction that have as an inadvertent byproduct of their existence senescence or aging. So aging itself may not necessarily be genetically programmed or fixed, but there are fixed programs for other attributes of the lifespan that inadvertently lead to senescence, and the difference between the two is like night and day. And it is important to recognize the distinction between them. The second point I would make has to do with the use of extrapolation methods in forecasting life expectancy, which I know was advocated as the primary or principal method suggested. And I think this is not a very good idea, at least not for more than about 20 years into the future. Actually, it was surprising that I saw somebody else show some data earlier indicating that indeed it was very good for 20 years, but beyond that it was a problem. And I've been making that argument for a long time to the trustees of the Social Security Administration of the United States that extrapolation models are not useful, principally because they completely ignore the underlying biology that influences the duration of life of humans. And I think we should not be ignoring the underlying biology. And in fact, up until today, my argument has been using extrapolation models is like driving your car with one eye closed. You have no depth perception at all. And it was suggested earlier by a new friend of mine that, in fact, a more accurate way of saying that is it's like driving your car by looking in the rearview mirror, which I think is not a very good idea. You're inevitably going to drive off the road. Now, I would also, in closing, like to mention one other thing, and that is a manuscript that my colleagues and I currently have under review, ironically, with the title, Will Human Life Expectancy Decline in the 21st Century? And we make the argument that we believe there is sufficient evidence that life expectancy at birth will decline in this century unless we reverse ongoing trends in obesity and the rise and reemergence of communicable diseases, which we think is possible, but the observed trend is not moving in that direction. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Could I ask if any of our guests want to speak?
David Coleman there.
David.
First, and thank you for inviting me to this distinguished company. I was going to make two points of a cohort nature relating to perhaps some obstacles in the way of the rather optimistic, upbeat scenario that we've heard so eloquently presented to us earlier on today. The first one on obesity has been made by one speaker and also by Professor Olshansky, so I can omit that one, but I think it's extraordinarily important. The second is much more speculative and tentative, but nonetheless derives from some work which was presented earlier on today at a meeting organized by the International Longevity Center and the British Society for Population Studies concerning population heterogeneity, in specific, the growth of the ethnic minority populations. Now, as you'll know, these comprise about 8% of the population of the country at the moment, but less than 1% of the older population, and hardly feature in mortality problems except for specific problems relating to infant mortality. However, this population will both grow and age if we have no official population projections for the ethnic minority population of the UK, but if those for other European countries are any guide, then it may well be that by mid-century this will be about 20% of the population, and of course through population aging, a much higher proportion than just 1% of the population over 65 where mortality tends to be concentrated. Therefore, it's going to matter. Now, you will doubtless know that earlier work on immigrants rather than ethnic minority SMRs revealed that, except for Scots and Irish, the SMRs of male immigrants of working age tended to be lower, not higher, than those of the general population, although those of females were often higher. So the outlook on that basis was for a boost, as it were, to expectation of life, not a decline. However, this A may be due to the so-called healthy migrant effect, and B appears to be somewhat contradicted by some tentative evidence coming out of small-scale population comparisons where there are high proportions of certain ethnic minority population, which are still in a development stage. These suggest there may well be problems with high mortality relating to the Bangladeshi and possibly the Pakistani population, maybe connected with social class, maybe connected with other aspects of poverty, maybe connected with diet or even to susceptibility of particular diseases like diabetes. These, of course, are those parts of the population because of high levels of migration, crucially, but also because of relatively high birth rate, which among the ethnic minority populations are going to be a bigger and bigger proportion in the future. If, therefore, these problems are real, if they are not matched or dealt with by some process of remedial action, then it may be that this is an issue which we'll have to take into account in future projections of mortality, as we certainly are having to in projections of the population and its social and other kinds of composition. Thank you.
Well, I think we've got time for three short contributions. Who would like? Anyone from over here?
One at the back.
One at the back?
Yeah, on the left.
Sorry.
On the left.
There. Oh, yes?
I think I've got to take a look.
I think you have a place.
My name is Julian Lee. I wish to discuss briefly some aspects of Section 7.11. I think it's about 20 years since judges couldn't tell the difference between actuaries and astrologers, They then corrected the error and came up with the Ogden tables, which caused a substantial increase in compensation costs for long-term injury in the United Kingdom. Those aren't specifically related, or the increases aren't specifically related to longevity. They're a recognition of the actual cost of providing compensation for people's lives at the levels required. Furthermore, I don't believe that there are particular longevity implications in the way the business is mostly currently written, as most claims are paid out within a few years. It's an aspect, however, of this business that's briefly alluded to in 7.11.6 that I wish to mention, and that is the move in recent years towards structured settlements. I believe that most people who have considered this question in depth consider that structured settlements are a far better way of compensating people and making sure that the amount of compensation actually meet their needs. However, if it happens, and it hasn't happened much to date, rather because of the reluctance of injured people to accept this form of compensation, it will increase greatly the reserves that insurance companies have to hold against these claims because they will not be discharged immediately they are settled. And those reserves, which will be paid off over injured people's lifetimes, will have a substantial longevity risk included in them. This will have to be allowed for, and indeed aspects of solvency that arise out of this particular longevity risk will have to be allowed for when we're considering the risk that the amounts set aside in companies' reserves will not be sufficient to pay all claims. I recognise that the class of people concerned is a very small one, and tracing their longevity separately would be a very difficult task. On the other hand, they are all a thoroughly impaired class of lives, and to automatically assume that the longevity projections that are made for the population as a whole might well be misleading, although it's impossible to tell in what direction it might be misleading. So I thank the authors greatly for this paper. It's not a paper that concentrates on an area in which I consider myself a specialist in any way, but I found it easy to read and understand throughout, and I think that's a major tribute to them. Thank you.
Alison O'Connell, of course, being female, I have a greater personal interest in longevity than any of the previous speakers. I also am a self-confessed mortality geek, not only an actuary, but having studied gerontology. And like Richard Willetts, it was a great surprise to me to find that there was so much in demographic academic literature that actuaries just didn't know. And I think if there's one thing this paper demonstrates is that putting all this information into the actuarial reading will be a very great step forward. Now, my question is also how to use this paper, in particular in my field, pensions policy. There will be many people in this room that think it's absolutely obvious that what this paper says, that we're all going to live longer, means that the age in which state pension benefits should start to be payable should go up. We've done quite a bit of work on that, and I have to tell you that it does not seem obvious to many people outside of this room. In fact, it seems totally unacceptable. And I think that what needs to happen for the view that longevity does make a difference to state pension age to be more widely understood is that the implications have to be communicated in real terms to people. One idea we've floated is that the government is planning to issue pension benefit forecasts to people of working age every year. And if the latest estimates of how long people were expected to live from their state pension age were on those statements, it might encourage people to think about how long their pension might need to keep their standard of living going. Now, who would calculate that figure? Well, actuaries, of course. But then actuaries would have to get over their usual difficulties with the funnel of doubt and actually plump for a number that can be communicated well to people that don't often visit this room. I would say that this paper is so important and the implications just so widespread and important to all of us that need pensions that I hope we're all going to rise to the challenge of making the implications understandable in the real world. Thank you.
One more? All done? Okay. I'll ask Peter Noel to close the discussion.
Right, what a discussion. That's great. Richard... However... Richard mentioned that he discovered a paper that changed his view on this subject, and certainly his paper in 1999 did that for me. I thought that was terrific. The Cowell paper, and I think these papers, take that work on, and they're also a jolly good read, which I think several people have said. Neil Robjohns mentioned the lack of exposure at the 2004 Pensions Conference, and I hope that that is not going to happen in the future, and that pensions people in particular discuss this issue, not least because Gary Cross mentioned the sheer size of the liability, a lot of that being obviously with the pension scheme area. Pension liability of $1.5 trillion, I think he said. If you're wrong by 1%, that costs $15 billion. That's £250, I think, per head of population. I'm sure I'll get some of these statistics wrong. And if we're wrong by 10%, that's £2,500 per head of population. So we're talking big numbers. He emphasised the huge improvements in life expectancy from birth and from age 65. And, I mean, I think he said that similar improvements could be possible from age 65 onwards in the 21st century. He thought the cohort effect did exist and is likely to continue. Circulatory disease reduction is key to recent improvements, and this is related to smoking. He emphasised the funnel of doubt, which increases with time, and that sort of improvement will build on recent improvements. But the danger is that there is some tendency to perhaps... that the original basis of CMR 17 perhaps didn't go far enough, but there may be a tendency to over-egg the improvements now, but on the other hand, well, there may not. And he emphasised the importance of further research being required. Ian Curry showed us the graphs that plotted longevity improvements and showed that they accelerated at the end of the 20th century, having been sort of really pretty much straight line before then. But he did illustrate that if you put a reasonable confidence interval around them, they were actually within a reasonable confidence limit. And that just shows how difficult it is to actually make projections going forward for any length of time. David Brand discussed annuity business and the issue that certainly annuity business at the moment is a lot less selective than term business. And that clearly impaired lives are more attractive as annuitants, particularly because obviously one's talking about a shorter predicted lifetime. David Gulland talked about the importance of socioeconomic grouping and linked this potentially to diet, and that's certainly something which I think a lot of work can be done on, particularly I think in the pensions area, the pension scheme area, as opposed to life assurance. Eugene Hertzman said that the CMR 17 almost certainly, well, did run off the longevity improvement much too quickly. However, he also felt that it was much more difficult to work out whether the current projection was right or not. The smoking effect, which has largely actually been through improvements to sort of the reduction in heart disease, that the relevance of smoking would shift towards lung cancer, and that the over 70 mortality improvements, which is present in the recent data from the CMI, needed explanation. And he asked for careful reflection on the projection basis, and that he thought that medical advances were the key to at least a best guess at what might be a reasonable projection basis. Richard Humble had a similar theme. Cohort effect is largely related to smoking. If the smoking effect has run its course, then the medium cohort projection is too strong. Improvements after the cohort effect runs off, that he felt that the assumption of the same reduction in mortality at all ages needed to be challenged, that it was a simplifying assumption. Gavin Jones said that considering the understanding of stochastic variation, if we could understand that bit of it as opposed to the actual trend, then this would help companies diversify their portfolio by diversifying the diversifiable risk and therefore reduce the risk capital required, which would help somewhat. But nevertheless, long-term deferred annuities and pension schemes did present a big risk. And the risk of selection, particularly going forward, is also a major risk. Philip Oliver discussed the problems of relating longevity to risk capital and the limitations of a stochastic approach, and he favoured for the sort of range approach, the trend approach, either scenarios or ranges. Brian Ridsdale highlighted the desirability of trustees being made to reveal their longevity assumptions, which is not a requirement at the moment. He also emphasised the importance of actuaries emphasising the expanding funnel of doubt, that it's not so much the actual projection trend you actually plump for, but the uncertainty around it, particularly as times develop. Andrew Smith introduced the concept of how you actually allow for GAO options and embedded options in other types of insurance contracts, and suggested a number of issues which will emerge from that, which are sort of analogous to the sort of problems you get with a stochastic projection of the stock market. And I think that's a very interesting area for actuaries to get involved with as well. Mike Wadsworth argued that that actuaries should promote discussion on longevity risk and, for instance, promote the pooling of the variability of mortality, the stochastic element of mortality, but even if we can't actually offer insurance for the actual trend. Peter Akers also had the same issue that, yes, the longevity improvement is a problem essentially for insuring that risk, and suggested a state-sponsored longevity risk insurance. Sir Richard Dowell gave us some very interesting insights into his survey of doctors over a long period. And I think I got it right that he said that whereas there wasn't really any change in the survival rates for smokers within the doctor group, that whereas there was a 3% survival rate to age 90 in the 1950s, that this had increased to 33% in the 1990s cohort. So, I mean, that just illustrating the importance, I think, of smoking in all of this. J.L. Shensky, I think, gave us his view about the natural senescence effect, that it's not a question of a biological limit to life, but it is to do with his view that there is a senescence effect within the process, which means that's something which will not disappear. And he emphasised that extrapolation models without an explanation of why a trend is going to improve is like driving a car with a rear view mirror. David Coleman mentioned issues such as obesity and communicable diseases, which might actually make longevity improvements much less in the future or help to offset any improvements in medical advances in the 21st century. He also suggested, interestingly, that the immigration issue could actually change the population longevity projections, because I think it was 8% of the population is currently from ethnic minorities, whereas it's only 1% of the over 65s. And clearly that is quite a significant effect and something that certainly the population needs to consider, although I'm not quite sure where that fits in with the CMI's type life assurance
I'm not sure what the relative figures are there. Julian Lee discussed the impact of the paper on structured settlements, where obviously it's a shorter-term issue, but nevertheless it's still significant. And Alison O'Connell discussed the importance of ensuring that the link between longevity and the discussion of raising the retirement age is made clear, if you like, or the actuaries can help to make clear to the population what the problem is, because they don't at the moment make that link. I think it's interesting that going through this process of trying to sort of summarise what's been happening, sometimes there's an awful lot of repetition in what people say, and therefore it's really quite difficult to summarise what people have said. I think what's really quite striking tonight is that everybody has made a different contribution, an interesting point, and I think that really that's the purpose of this sort of meeting and the opportunity over the next 12 months or so to have a major go at discussing the subject of longevity. So rather than congratulate the authors, I think I'd like to congratulate the speakers tonight on the range of their contributions, and I think that bodes well for the future. I think it is a key issue for the profession, particularly over the next 12 months or so, and particularly when we seek a projection basis for the for life insurance going forward. Thank you very much.
Now Stephen Richards and Richard Willits will respond to the discussion, and the corks are popping.
Okay, I'll try and be brief. I'd like to start by thanking all the contributors. They've raised a very large number of wide-ranging points. I won't be able to address all of them, but I would stress I'm replying in a personal capacity rather than on behalf of the working party. I haven't had time, obviously, to confer with my fellow colleagues. Gary Cross highlighted the wide impact of increasing longevity in society. However, I do feel that life offices are somewhat far ahead of the game compared to some of the others he mentioned. In particular, I personally am very far from convinced that shareholders and finance directors fully understand the longevity risk that is inherent in the large and maturing defined benefit pension schemes that are often attached to the companies concerned. Mr. Croft also mentioned the role of changing smoking patterns, particularly their differential impact on different causes of death. He was disappointed that the paper did not take this into account in some of its projection bases. In response, I would say that smoking patterns are very strongly differentiated by socioeconomic group. To properly do what Mr. Croft suggests, an actuary has to first understand the nature of the population whose benefits he's trying to value. The members of an industrial blue-collar pension scheme, for example, have very, very different smoking patterns from a white-collar pension scheme. We certainly could do what Mr. Croft suggested, but this would actually not have helped our actuary much, as he still needs to make very specific, scheme-specific assumptions when valuing benefits. David Brand mentioned the operation and existence of the annuity market, in particular the annuity market for impaired lives and the effect that this has on the standard annuity market. The flip side of this effect is the very urgent need for a proper and robust allowance for anti-selection when pricing standard annuities. Eugene Hertzman mentioned the very sharp improvement in mortality rates in the elderly over the past 4 years and inquired about any analysis by cause of death. In fact, the Office of National Statistics has very recently released a commentary and analysis of trends in seasonal mortality. Over the period he mentions, the excess of winter deaths over summer deaths has been particularly low since about 1999. Since influenza plays a very important role in mortality of the elderly, whether it's stated on the death certificate or not, the past 4 years may have been unusually kind to the elderly in the UK. Certainly, if you converse with general practitioners, they think that we're actually overdue some kind of influenza epidemic. Richard Humble outlined some details of his own model of mortality improvements, in particular the relationship to smoking. He suggested that the CMIB mid-intensity cohort projection might overstate future improvements and that his own model implies annuity reserves, and I quote, some percentage points lower. I very much look forward to Mr. Humble presenting his model to the profession for scrutiny and discussion at a later date. Numerous commentators mentioned stochastic projection methods. I was particularly delighted to hear mention of stochastic projection of mortality trends. I would say that the subject was deliberately not covered in our main paper under discussion tonight and is in fact explicitly addressed by a contemporaneous paper by another different CMIB working party. And this is working paper number 3, available on the profession's website. I also appreciated Andrew Smith's analysis of the optionality inherent in many common financial products. As a regular rebroker of my own term assurance, I was relieved to hear that I'm not the only one who sees embedded options in even the simplest product. However, the risks associated with such embedded optionality are not equally spread across the annuity market, for example. To pick just one particular risk, that of anti-selection in the standard annuity, this applies only to the holders of pension funds who actually exercise their open market option, and in my own office we see no evidence of anti-selection in what we would regard as the internal vesting book, those who do not exercise their open market option. Finally, Pete Akers mentioned the absence of a meaningful reinsurance market for longevity risk, and one solution offered was the possibility of a state-sponsored reinsurance scheme. This would indeed be a very interesting scheme, although I personally feel that the governments of the Western world have more than enough unfunded longevity risk in their hands as things stand. Even the UK is not immune, as Table 7.12a shows. Unfunded public sector scheme liabilities have grown much faster than tax receipts over the last 20 years. And that's not even to begin to contemplate the unfunded liabilities implied by state pension benefits. Of course, unlike insurers, governments don't have to reserve for their promises. In fact, also unlike insurers, governments can also change the nature of the benefits midway through the contract.
I'm not going to take up very much more of your time, you'll be glad to hear. I'd just like to conclude by also thanking everybody who's contributed to the excellent debate this evening. Stephen has very ably addressed some of the specifics points raised, but I think in a more general sense it's a very positive development that we're able to discuss some of the many aspects of this vast topic. I'm actually particularly pleased that we're seeing an emerging debate regarding the impact of smoking. And I think perhaps the past weakness of actuarial work in the mortality field has stemmed from an actual lack of challenge and debate in this area. I think the existence of opposing opinions is often a sign of strength rather than weakness. And there are many areas where differing outlooks exist. Some commentators point to a rising tide of obesity set to reverse increases in life expectancy. Others suggest that heart disease deaths may be almost eliminated within 10 years. Virtually all mortality projections assume that the pace of improvement will decelerate over time. Some feel this is realistic, others question this fundamental assumption. In relation to the UK cohort effect, there is a growing debate as to how strongly and for how long this trend will be projected forwards. Some see no sign of the trend diminishing, others, perhaps because of past trends in smoking, believe it will fade with time. I very much look forward to continuing debate and discussion of these and other key questions. So finally, I'd just like to thank all the other members of the Working Party for the considerable time and effort that went into production of the paper. We were also aided by many others along the way, too numerous to mention, but I would also like to single out Maria Lyons at the Actuarial Profession for her help in organising the production of the two papers presented this evening. Okay, thank you.
I'd like to add a couple of very brief comments of my own. I'd really like to see these ideas and indeed warnings about longevity in these papers and in the emerging CMI tables accepted and taken back, particularly in life companies and pension funds, so that we can apply them maybe with reasoned modifications, with prudent margins for adverse deviation. So we get back to the old days then when reserves actually released a positive amount in the analysis of variance at the end of the year. Secondly, I'd like to just, I really realise really this evening when it was mentioned, to thank the contribution of Angus MacDonald and Heriot Watt University in the encouragement of Richard Willetts in particular and his team in these papers. And I'd just like to say, it seems to me that mortality may be geeky, but longevity is alive and well and living in Staple Inn. So I'd like to express my own thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to the authors, opener, closer, and all those who participated in this evening's discussion. It would be very helpful for those preparing the transcripts of the discussion for the BAJ if you could hand any prepared notes to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave. I'd like to draw your attention to a seminar on Friday the 4th of June at 2 o'clock in this hall, when two CMI working papers as part of the consultative process in producing new mortality tables will be presented. The audience will be those who can give feedback on projection methodology and give guidance on which tables should be graduated. The next sessional meeting of the Institute will take place at 5 o'clock on Monday the 24th of May at the Council House in Birmingham, when a discussion on the Penrose Report is scheduled to take place. The meeting will take place in the purpose-built Council Chamber and dinner will be held in the Banqueting Suite. Booking form and further details are available on the website or by contacting Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at Napier House. Please note that places in the Council Chamber and for dinner are strictly limited and must be booked in advance. I'd also like to remind you of the AGM, which will take place on Monday, the 5th of July. You're now warmly invited to continue the discussion and join us for a glass of wine in the Council Chamber. With those attending Gallio and other dining clubs, please ensure that they leave on time. I declare the meeting closed.